This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Allison Hester of Athens, Georgia. Chapter 2 of the SS Titanic by Lawrence Beasley. From Southampton to the Night of the Collision. Soon after noon, the whistles blew for friends to go ashore. The gangways were withdrawn, and the Titanic moved slowly down the dock to the accompaniment of last messages and shouted farewells of those on the quay. There was no cheering or hooting of steamers' whistles from the fleet of ships that lined the dock, as might seem probable, on the occasion of the largest vessel in the world putting to sea on her maiden voyage. The whole scene was quiet and rather ordinary, with little of the picturesque and interesting ceremonial which imagination paints as usual in such circumstances. But if this was lacking, two unexpected dramatic incidents supplied a thrill of excitement and interest to the departure from the dock. The first of these occurred just before the last gangway was withdrawn. A knot of stokers ran along the quay with their kit slung over their shoulders in bundles and made for the gangway with the evident intention of joining the ship. But a petty officer guarding the shore end of the gangway firmly refused to allow them on board. They argued, gesticulated, apparently attempting to explain the reasons why they were late, but he remained obdurate and waved them back with a determined hand. The gangway was dragged back amid the protests, putting a summary ending to their determined efforts to join the Titanic. Those stokers must be thankful men today that some circumstance, whether their own lack of punctuality or some unforeseen delay over which they had no control, prevented their being in time to run up that last gangway. They will have told, and will no doubt tell for years, the story of how their lives were probably saved by being too late to join the Titanic. The second incident occurred soon afterwards, and while it has no doubt been thoroughly described at the time by those on shore, perhaps a view of the occurrence from the deck of the Titanic will not be without interest. As the Titanic moved majestically down the dock, the crowd of friends keeping pace with us along the quay, we came together level with the steamer New York lying moored to the side of the dock, along with the Oceanic, the crowd waving goodbyes to those on board as well as they could for the intervening bulk of the two ships. But as the bows of our ship came about level with those of the New York, there came a series of reports like those of a revolver, and on the quay side of the New York, snaky coils of thick rope flung themselves high in the air and fell backwards among the crowd, which retreated in alarm to escape the flying ropes. We hoped that no one was struck by the ropes, but a sailor next to me was certain he saw a woman carried away to receive attention. And then, to our amazement, the New York crept toward us, slowly and stealthily, as if drawn by some invisible force which she was powerless to withstand. It reminded me instantly of an experiment I had shown many times to a form of boys learning the elements of physics in a laboratory, in which a small magnet is made to float on a cork in a bowl of water, and small steel objects placed on neighboring pieces of cork are drawn up to the floating magnet by magnetic force. It reminded me, too, of seeing in my little boy's bath how a large celluloid floating duck would draw towards itself by what is called capillary attraction. Smaller ducks, frogs, beetles, and other animal folk, until the menagerie floated about as a unit, oblivious of their natural antipathies and reminding us of the happy families one sees in cages on the seashore. On the New York, there was shouting of orders, sailors running to and fro, paying out ropes and putting mats over the side where it seemed likely we should collide. The tug, which had a few moments before cast off from the bows of the Titanic, came up around our stern and passed to the quay side of the New York stern, made fast to her, and started to haul her back with all the force her engines were capable of. But it did not seem that the tug made much impression on the New York. Apart from the serious nature of the accident, it made an irresistibly comic picture to see the huge vessel drifting down the dock with a snorting tug at its heels, for all the world like a small boy dragging a diminutive puppy down the road with its teeth locked on a piece of rope, its feet splayed out, its head and body shaking from side to side in the effort to get every ounce of its weight used to the best advantage. At first, all appearance showed that the sterns of the two vessels would collide, but from the stern bridge of the Titanic, an officer directing operations stopped us dead. The suction ceased, and the New York, with her tug trailing behind, moved obliquely down the dock, her stern gliding along the side of the Titanic some few yards away. It gave an extraordinary impression of the absolute helplessness of a big liner in the absence of any motive power to guide her. But all excitement was not yet over. The New York turned her bows inward towards the quay, her stern swinging just clear of and passing in front of our bows, and moved slowly head on for the Teutonic lying moored to the side. Mats were quickly got out and so deadened the force of the collision, which, from where we were, seemed to be too slight to cause any damage. Another tug came up and took hold of the New York by the bows, and between the two of them, they dragged her round the corner of the quay, which just here came to an end on the side of the river. We now moved slowly ahead and passed the Teutonic at a creeping pace, but notwithstanding this, the latter strained at her rope so much that she heeled over several degrees in her efforts to follow the Titanic. The crowd were shouted back. A group of gold-braided officials, probably the harbor master and his staff, standing on the seaside of the moored ropes, jumped back over them as they drew up taut to a rigid line and urged the crowd back still farther. But we were just clear, and as we slowly turned the corner into the river, I saw the Teutonic swing slowly back into her normal station, relieving the tension alike of the ropes and of the minds of all who had witnessed the incident. Unpleasant as this incident was, it was interesting to all the passengers leaning over the rails to see the means adopted by the officers and crew of the various vessels to avoid collision, to see on the Titanic's docking bridge, at the stern, an officer and seaman telephoning and ringing bells, hauling up and down little red and white flags as danger of collision alternately threatened and diminished. No one was more interested than a young American movie photographer, who, with his wife, followed the whole scene with eager eyes, turning the handle of his camera with the most evident pleasure as he recorded the unexpected incident on his films. It was obviously quite a windfall for him to have been on board at such a time, but neither the film nor those who exposed it reached the other side, and the record of the accident from the Titanic's deck has never been thrown on the screen. As we steamed down the river, the scene we had just witnessed was the topic of every conversation. The comparison with the Olympic Hawk collision was drawn in every little group of passengers, and it seemed to be generally agreed that this would confirm the suction theory, which was so successfully advanced by the cruiser Hawk in the law courts, but which many people scoffed at when the British Admiralty first suggested it as the explanation of the cruiser ramming the Olympic. And since this is an attempt to chronicle facts as they happened on board the Titanic, it must be recorded that there were among the passengers, and such of the crew as were heard to speak on the matter, the direst misgivings at the incident we had just witnessed. Sailors are proverbially superstitious. Far too many people are prone to follow their lead, or, indeed, the lead of anyone who asserts a statement with an air of conviction and the opportunity of constant repetition. The sense of mystery that shrouds a prophetic utterance, particularly if it be an ominous one, for so constituted apparently is the human mind that it will receive the impress of an evil prophecy far more readily than it will of a beneficent one, possibly through subservient fear to the thing it dreads, possibly through the degraded morbid attraction which the sense of evil has for the innate evil in the human mind, leads many people to pay a certain respect to the superstitious theories. Not that they wholly believe in them or would wish their dearest friends to know they ever gave them a second thought, but the feeling that other people do so and the half-conviction that there may be something in it after all sways them into tacit obedience to the most absurd and childish theories. I wish, in a later chapter, to discuss the subject of superstition and its reference to our life on board the Titanic, but will anticipate events here a little by relating a second so-called bad omen, which was hatched at Queenstown. As one of the tenders containing passengers and mails near the Titanic, some of those on board gazed up at the liner towering above them and saw a stoker's head, black from his work, in the stokehold below, peering out at them from the top of one of the enormous funnels, a dummy one for ventilation, that rose many feet above the highest deck. He had climbed up inside for a joke, but to some of those who saw him there, the sight was seed for the growth of an omen, which bore fruit and an unknown dread of dangers to come. An American lady, may she forgive me if she reads these lines, has related to me with the deepest conviction and earnestness of manner that she saw the man and attributes the sinking of the Titanic largely to that. Arrant foolishness, you may say? Yes, indeed, but not to those who believe in it. And it is well not to have such prophetic thoughts of danger passed round among passengers and crew. It would seem to have an unhealthy influence. We dropped down Spithead, past the shores of the Isles of Wight, looking superbly beautiful in new spring foliage, exchanged salutes with a White Star tug lying to in wait for one of their liners inward bound, and saw in the distance several warships with attendant black destroyers guarding the entrance from sea. In the calmest weather, we made Cherbourg just as it grew dusk, and left again about 8:30, after taking on board passengers and mails. We reached Queenstown about 12 noon on Thursday, after a most enjoyable passage across the channel, although the wind was almost too cold to allow of sitting out on deck on Thursday morning. The coast of Ireland looked very beautiful as we approached the Queenstown harbor, the brilliant morning sun showing up the green hillsides and picking out groups of dwellings dotted here and there above the rugged gray cliffs that fringed the coast. We took on board our pilot, ran slowly towards the harbor with the sounding line dropped all the time, and came to a stop well out to sea, with our screws churning up the bottom and turning the sea all brown with sand from below. It had seemed to me that the ship stopped rather suddenly, and in my ignorance of the depth of the harbor entrance, that perhaps the sounding line had revealed a smaller depth than was thought safe for the great size of the Titanic. This seemed to be confirmed by the sight of sand churned up from the bottom, but this is mere supposition. Passengers and mails were put on board from two tenders, and nothing could have given us a better idea of the enormous length and bulk of the Titanic than to stand as far astern as possible and look over the side from the top deck, forwards and downwards to where the tenders rolled at her bows, the merest cockle shells beside the majestic vessel that rose deck after deck above them. Truly, she was a magnificent boat. There was something so graceful in her movement as she rode up and down on the slight swell in the harbor, a slow, stately dip and recover, only noticeable by watching her bows in comparison with some landmark on the coast in the near distance. The two little tenders tossing up and down like corks beside her illustrated vividly the advance made in comfort of motion from the time of a small steamer. Presently, the work of transfer was ended, the tenders cast off, and at 1:30 p.m., with the screws churning up the sea bottom again, the Titanic turned slowly through a quarter circle until her nose pointed down along the Irish coast, and then steamed rapidly away from Queenstown, the little house on the left of the town gleaming white on the hillside for many miles astern. In our wake soared and screamed hundreds of gulls, which had quarreled and fought over the remnants of lunch pouring out of the waste pipes as we lay to in the harbor entrance, and now they followed us in the expectation of further spoil. I watched them for a long time and was astounded at the ease with which they soared and kept up with the ship, with hardly a motion of their wings. Picking out a particular gull, I would keep him under observation for minutes at a time and see no motion of his wings downward or upwards to aid in his flight. He would tilt all of a piece to one side or another as the gusts of wind caught him, rigidly unbendable, as an airplane tilts sideways in a puff of wind. And yet, with graceful ease, he kept pace with the Titanic, forging through the water at 20 knots. As the wind met him, he would rise upwards and obliquely forwards and come down slantingly again, his wings curved in a beautiful arch and his tail feathers outspread as a fan. It was plain that he possessed of a secret we are only just beginning to learn, that of utilizing air currents as escalators up and down, which he can glide at will with the expenditure of the minimum amount of energy, or of using them as a ship does when it sails within one or two points of a headwind. Aviators, of course, are imitating the gull, and soon, perhaps, we may see an airplane or a glider dipping gracefully up and down in the face of an opposing wind and all the time forging ahead across the Atlantic. The gulls were still behind us when night fell, and still they screamed and dipped down into the broad wake of foam which we'd left behind. But in the morning, they were gone. Perhaps they had seen in the night a steamer bound for their Queenstown home and had escorted her back. All afternoon we steamed along the coast of Ireland, with gray cliffs guarding the shores, and hills rising behind, gaunt and barren. As dusk fell, the coast rounded away from us to the northwest, and the last we saw of Europe was the Irish mountains, dim and faint in the dropping darkness. With the thought that we had seen the last of land until we set foot on the shores of America, I retired to the library to write letters, little knowing that many things would happen to us all, many experiences, sudden, vivid, and impressive to be countered, many perils to be faced, many good and true people for whom we should have had to mourn before we saw land again. There is very little to relate from the time of leaving Queenstown on Thursday to Sunday morning. The sea was calm, so calm indeed, that very few were absent from Mills. The wind westerly and southwesterly, fresh, as the daily chart described it, but often rather cold, generally too cold to sit out on deck to read or write, so that many of us spent a good part of our time in the library reading and writing. I wrote a large number of letters and posted them day by day in the box outside the library door. Possibly they are there yet. Each morning the sun rose behind us in a sky of circular clouds, stretching round the horizon in long, narrow streaks and rising tier upon tier above the skyline, red and pink and fading from pink to white as the sun rose higher in the sky. It was indeed a beautiful sight to one who had not crossed the ocean before, or, indeed, been out of sight of the shores of England, to stand on the top deck and watch the swell of the sea extending outwards from the ship in an unbroken circle until it met the skyline with its hint of infinity. Behind, the wake of the vessel, white with foam, where, fancy suggested, the propeller blades had cut up the long Atlantic rollers, and with them made a level white road bounded on either side by banks of green, blue, and blue-green waves that would presently sweep away the white road, though, as yet, it stretched back to the horizon and dipped over the edge of the world back to Ireland and the Gulls, while along it the morning sun glittered and sparkled. And each night, the sun sank right in our eyes along with the sea, making an undulating, glittering pathway, a golden track charted on the surface of the ocean, which our ship followed unswervingly until the sun dipped below the edge of the horizon, and the pathway ran ahead of us, faster than we could steam, and slipped over the edge of the skyline, as if the sun had been a golden ball and had wound up its thread of gold too quickly for us to follow. From 12 noon Thursday to 12 noon Friday, we ran 386 miles. Friday to Saturday, 519 miles. And Saturday to Sunday, 546 miles. The second day's run of 519 miles was, the purser told us, a disappointment, and we should not dock until Wednesday morning instead of Tuesday night, as we had expected. However, on Sunday we were glad to see a longer run had been made, and it was thought we should make New York after all on Tuesday night. The purser remarked, "They are not pushing her this trip and don't intend to make any fast running. I don't suppose we shall do more than 546 now. It is not a bad day's run for the first trip." This was at lunch, and I remember the conversation then turned to the speed and build of Atlantic liners as factors in their comfort of motion. All those who had crossed many times were unanimous in saying that the Titanic was the most comfortable boat they had been on, and they preferred the speed we were making to that of the faster boats, from the point of view of lessened vibration, as well as because the faster boats would bore through the waves with a twisted, screw-like motion instead of the straight up and down swing of the Titanic. I then called the attention of our table to the way the Titanic listed to port. I had noticed this before, and we all watched the skyline through the portholes as we sat at the purser's table in the saloon. It was plain she did so, for the skyline and sea on the port side were visible most of the time, and on the starboard only sky. The purser remarked that probably coal had been used mostly from the starboard side. It is no doubt a common occurrence for all vessels to list to some degree, but in view of the fact that the Titanic was cut open on the starboard side, and before she sank listed so much to port that there was quite a chasm between her and the swinging lifeboats, across which ladies had to be thrown or to cross on chairs laid flat, the previous listing to port may be of interest. Returning for a moment to the motion of the Titanic, it was interesting to stand on the boat deck, as I frequently did, in the angle between lifeboats 13 and 15 on the starboard side. Two boats I have every reason to remember, for the first carried me in safety to the Carpathia, and it seemed likely at one time that the other would come down on our heads as we sat in 13 trying to get away from the ship's side, and watched the general motion of the ship through the waves resolve itself into two motions, one to be observed by contrasting the docking bridge from which the log line trailed away behind the foaming wake with the horizon, and observing the long, slow heave as we rode up and down. I timed the average period occupied in one up and down vibration, but do not now remember the figures. The second motion was a side-to-side roll and could be calculated by watching the port rail and contrasting it with the horizon as before. It seems likely that this double motion is due to the angle at which our direction to New York cuts the general set of the Gulf Stream sweeping from the Gulf of Mexico across to Europe. But the almost clock-like regularity of the two vibratory movements was what attracted my attention. It was while watching the side roll that I first became aware of the list to port. Looking down astern from the boat deck, or from B deck to the steerage quarters, I often noticed how the third-class passengers were enjoying every minute of the time. A most uproarious skipping game of the mixed double type was a great favorite, while in and out and roundabout, when a Scotchman with his bagpipes playing something that Gilbert says faintly resembled an air. Standing aloof from all of them, generally on the raised stern deck above the playing field, was a man of about 20 to 24 years of age, well-dressed, always gloved and nicely groomed, and obviously quite out of place among his fellow passengers. He never looked happy all the time. I watched him and classified him at hazard as the man who had been a failure in some way at home and had received the proverbial shilling plus third-class fare to America. He did not look resolute enough or happy enough to be working out his own problem. Another interesting man was traveling steerage, but had placed his wife in the second cabin. He would climb the stairs leading from the steerage to the second deck and talk affectionately with his wife across the low gate which separated them. I never saw him after the collision, but I think his wife was on the Carpathia. Whether they ever saw each other on the Sunday night is very doubtful. He would not at first be allowed on the second-class deck, and if he were, the chances of seeing his wife in the darkness and the crowd would be very small indeed. Of all those playing so happily on the steerage deck, I did not recognize many afterwards on the Carpathia. Coming now to Sunday, the day on which the Titanic struck the iceberg, it will be interesting, perhaps, to give the day's events in some detail, to appreciate the general attitude of passengers to their surroundings just before the collision. Service was held in the saloon by the purser in the morning, and going on deck after lunch, we found such a change in temperature that not many cared to remain to face the bitter wind, an artificial wind created mainly, if not entirely, by the ship's rapid motion through the chilly atmosphere. I should judge that there was no wind blowing at the time, for I had noticed about the same force of wind approaching Queenstown, to find that it died away as soon as we stopped, only to rise again as we steamed away from the harbor. Returning to the library, I stopped for a moment to read again the day's run and observe our position on the chart. The Reverend Mr. Carter, a clergyman of the Church of England, was similarly engaged, and we renewed a conversation we had enjoyed for some days. It had commenced with a discussion of the relative merits of his university, Oxford, with mine, Cambridge, as worldwide educational agencies, the opportunities at each for the formation of character, apart from mere education as such, and had led on to the lack of sufficiently qualified men to take up the work of the Church of England, a matter, apparently, on which he felt very deeply, and from that to his own work in England as a priest. He told me some of his parish problems and spoke of the impossibility of doing half his work in his church without the help his wife gave. I knew her only slightly at that time, but meeting her later in the day, I realized something of what he meant in attributing a large part of what success he had as a vicar to her. My only excuse for mentioning these details about the Carters, now and later in the day, is that while they have perhaps not much interest for the average reader, they will no doubt be some comfort to the parish over which he presided and where I am sure he was loved. He next mentioned the absence of a service in the evening and asked if I knew the purser well enough to request the use of the saloon in the evening, where he would like to have a hymn sing-song. The purser gave his consent at once, and Mr. Carter made preparations during the afternoon by asking all he knew, and many he did not, to come to the saloon at 8:30 p.m. The library was crowded that afternoon, owing to the cold on deck, but through the windows we could see the clear sky with brilliant sunlight that seemed to augur a fine night and a clear day tomorrow, and the prospect of landing in 2 days, with calm weather all the way to New York, was a matter of general satisfaction among us all. I can look back and see every detail of the library that afternoon. The beautifully furnished room with lounges, armchairs, and small writing or card tables scattered about, writing bureaus round the walls of the room, and the library in glass-cased shelves flanking one side, the whole finished in mahogany relieved with white fluted wooden columns that supported the deck above. Through the windows, there is the covered corridor, reserved by general consent as the children's playground. And here are playing the two Navatril children with their father, devoted to them, never absent from them. Who would have thought of the dramatic history of the happy group at play in the corridor that afternoon? The abduction of the children and niece, the assumed name, the separation of father and children in a few hours, his death, and their subsequent union with their mother after a period of doubt as to their parentage. How many more similar secrets the Titanic revealed in the privacy of family life, or carried down with her untold, we shall never know. In the same corridor is a man and his wife with 2 children, and one of them he is generally carrying. They are all young and happy. He is dressed always in a gray knickerbocker suit with a camera slung over his shoulder. I have not seen any of them since that afternoon. Close beside me, so near that I cannot avoid hearing scraps of their conversation, are 2 American ladies, both dressed in white, young, probably friends only. One has been to India and is returning by way of England. The other is a school teacher in America, a graceful girl, with a distinguished air heightened by a pair of pince-nez. Engaged in conversation with them is a gentleman who I subsequently identified from a photograph as a well-known resident of Cambridge, Massachusetts, genial, polished, and with a courtly air towards the 2 ladies, whom he has known but a few hours. From time to time, as they talk, a child acquaintance breaks in on their conversation and insists on their taking notice of a large doll clasped in her arms. I have seen none of this group since then. In the opposite corner are the young American movie photographer and his young wife, evidently French, very fond of playing patience, which she is doing now, while he sits back in his chair watching the game and interposing from time to time with suggestions. I did not see them again. In the middle of the room are 2 Catholic priests, one quietly reading, either English or Irish, and probably the latter. The other, dark, bearded, with broad-brimmed hat, talking earnestly to a friend in German and evidently explaining some verse in the open Bible before him. Near them, a young fire engineer on his way to Mexico, and of the same religion as the rest of the group. None of them were saved. It may be noted here that the percentage of men saved in the second class is the lowest of any other division, only 8%. Many other faces recur to thought, but it is impossible to describe them all in the space of a short book. Of all those in the library that Sunday afternoon, I can remember only 2 or 3 persons who found their way to the Carpathia. Looking over this room, with his back to the library shelves, is the library steward, thin, stooping, sad-faced, and generally with nothing to do but serve out books. But this afternoon, he is busier than I have ever seen him, serving out baggage declaration forms for passengers to fill in. Mine is before me as I write. Form for non-residents in the United States. Steamship Titanic, number 31444D, etc. I had filled it in that afternoon and slipped it into my pocketbook instead of returning it to the steward. Before me, too, is a small cardboard square. White Star Line, RMS Titanic, 208. This label must be given up when the article is returned. The property will be deposited in the purser's safe. The company will not be liable to passengers for the loss of money, jewels, or ornaments, by theft or otherwise, not so deposited. The property deposited in my case was money, placed in an envelope, sealed with my name written across the flap, and handed to the purser. The label is my receipt. Along with other similar envelopes, it may still be intact in the safe at the bottom of the sea, but in all probability, it is not, as will be seen presently. After dinner, Mr. Carter invited all who wished to the saloon, and with the assistance at the piano of a gentleman who sat at the purser's table opposite me, a young Scotch engineer going out to join his brother fruit farming at the foot of the Rockies, he started some 100 passengers singing hymns. They were asked to choose whichever hymn they wished, and with so many to choose, it was impossible for him to do more than just have the favorite sung. As he announced each hymn, it was evident that he was thoroughly versed in their history. No hymn was sung, but that he gave a short sketch of its author, and in some cases, a description of the circumstances in which it was composed. I think all were impressed with his knowledge of hymns and with his eagerness to tell us all he knew of them. It was curious to see how many chose hymns dealing with dangers at sea. I noticed that the hushed tone with which all sang the hymn for those in peril on the sea. The singing must have gone on until after 10 o'clock, when seeing the steward standing about waiting to serve biscuits and coffee before going off duty, Mr. Carter brought the evening to a close by saying a few words of thanks to the purser for use of the saloon, a short sketch of the happiness and safety of the voyage hitherto, the great confidence all felt on board this liner with her steadiness and her size, and the happy outlook of landing in a few hours in New York at the close of a delightful voyage. And all the time he spoke, a few miles ahead of us lay the peril on the sea that was to sink this great liner with many of those on board who listened with gratitude to his simple, heartfelt words. So much for the frailty of human hopes and for the confidence reposed in material human designs. Think of the shame of it, that a mass of ice of no use to anyone or anything should have the power to fatally injure the beautiful Titanic, that an insensible block should be able to threaten, even in the smallest degree, the lives of many good men and women who think and plan and hope and love, and not only to threaten, but to end their lives. It is unbearable. Are we never to educate ourselves to foresee such dangers and prevent them from happening? All the evidence of history shows that laws unknown and unsuspected are being discovered day by day. As this knowledge accumulates for the use of man, it is not certain that the ability to see and destroy beforehand the threat of danger will be one of the privileges the whole world will utilize. May that day come soon. Until it does, no precaution too rigorous can be taken. No safety appliance, however costly, must be omitted from a ship's equipment. After the meeting had broken up, I talked with the Carters over a cup of coffee, said good night to them, and retired to my cabin at about 10:45. They were good people, and this world is much poorer by their loss. It may be a matter of pleasure to many people to know that their friends were perhaps among that gathering of people in the saloon, and that, at the last, the sound of the hymn still echoed in their ears as they stood on the deck so quietly and courageously. Who can tell how much it had to do with the demeanor of some of them and the example this would set to others? End of Chapter 2 of SS Titanic by Lawrence Beasley.